This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
My guest today on Off the Shelf is an old favorite, Jason Workmaster. Jason is a partner at McKenna, Long & Aldridge, LLP, and focuses his practice on government contracts, contract compliance, Civil False Claims Act, all those kind of things that folks deal with when they're in the government contract space and they need a good lawyer. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. It's good to be back.
Well, hey, Jason, and it's great to have you again. Jason, actually, you spoke at the Coalition for Government Procurement's fall conference, which was, it was the week of October 25th, 24th, and you were on a panel that was discussing key compliance challenges with regard to the price reduction clause, pricing issues on GSA scheduled contracts. You know, how did that go for you?
I thought it was a very good discussion. The part that I spoke mostly about was, again, just these recent cases we've seen involving GSA schedule contractors in the False Claims Act context. And the issues that we continue to see there are the ones that have been that you and I have talked about on this show before, issues regarding, the initial pricing of the contracts, as you were suggesting, filling out that commercial sales practices format that schedule contractors need to fill out when they're applying for their schedule, disclosing their commercial sales practices. Issues involving the accuracy of those disclosures, and issues then involving compliance with the price reductions clause in virtually all GSA schedule contracts, the standard clause that says that when changes happen in your commercial discounting practices, that certain of those changes at least can trigger price reductions on your GSA schedule contract. So, we continue to see those issues involved in False Claims Act cases. And so I talked about that, and then the rest of the panel and I just chatted about where we see those issues headed in the future.
And, well, which leads to the next follow-up question. Where are things going in that arena in terms of, and we're talking about what is just about a $50 billion program. Mm-hmm. If you talk about the GSA schedules and then the schedules that the Department of Veterans Affairs manages pursuant to a delegation from GSA. Mm-hmm. So where are things going from your perspective?
It's one of those things where it's a little tough to pull out the crystal ball. But I think it's fair to say at least a couple things. One, we just recently in the last few weeks saw another big settlement involving a GSA scheduled contractor, almost $200 million. But now that we've seen a fair number of those over the last several years, but now that we've seen that one, as I mentioned at the conference, there aren't any that I'm aware of out there in the pipeline right now. So it could be that we're headed into a period where there's not going to be as much False Claims Act activity. And also, all those cases involved whistleblower actions, key TAM actions, which we'll talk a little bit more about that maybe later on in the show. So it might be that we're not going to see as many. But as we also discussed at the conference, this may be an opportune time for GSA and industry to talk about, since all those cases have settled and they haven't resulted in judicial decisions giving us more guidance on how you price GSA contracts and how you comply with the price reductions clause, it might be a good time for GSA and industry to get together to try and work through those issues. We know what the issues are that were raised in those cases and see if we can come up with ways to avoid them in the future.
Right. I think that would be benefit both sides. And it's that issue of there's a lot of gray in the rules around pricing and GSA schedules that should probably be clarified, and it almost seems like and let's go, you know, the conference was all about Mythbusters and communication between government and industry. So sounds to me like, Jason, you're talking about we have a Mythbusters opportunity here.
I think it's a classic Mythbusters opportunity, and it just is the kind of thing that cries out both for industry and GSA to get together on this, because this litigation is extremely expensive. The best way to resolve disputes is not, and I hate to say this, I'm a lawyer, to say it, but the best way to resolve disputes is not through the legal process. The best way to resolve disputes is for the two parties to get together, the two sides to get together, sit down and work together.
Right, and figure out what's, you know, given this way the program is now, because and I've talked a lot about the pricing policies, but we're talking about policies that are fundamentally almost 40 years old, and they haven't really been updated, since 1980s maybe, when there was a policy statement written, and then they were put in the GSA regulations in the 90s, but they all still basically are the same, same approach, that sort of thing, and it seems to me it is time to take a look at that and see where you can make some adjustments that that both sides could figure out in the long term benefit, especially with the growth of the competition requirements at the task order level.
Yes.
Well, did you have fun at the conference?
Oh, absolutely! It's always a delight to attend the conference.
Oh, that's good, and I had a great time as well. So. Now let's just turn to a little bit more in depth about the Civil False Claims Act, and let's just start with the basics. What should contractors know about that?
Well, just at the most basic level, they should know that the Civil False Claims Act, it's an old statute, goes back to the Civil War, and it's the government's primary tool for fighting fraud in procurement. And like I said, it's the Civil False Claims Act. There's also a Criminal False Claims Act. But the difference between the two is that civil fraud, unlike criminal fraud, the government doesn't have to prove the government doesn't have to prove that the contractor or the person submitting the claim meant to deceive the government. Right. The False Claims Act requires, a submission of a claim to the government, request for money somehow, and that's
got an invoice or whatever. Right?
Yeah, an invoice, a very broad definition of what a claim is, is done knowingly, but the definition of knowing in the Civil False Claims Act can be satisfied by a showing of reckless disregard for the truth or deliberate ignorance of the truth. So, and that's a very mushy standard. And it gives the government, and also these cases can be brought by whistleblowers, by or they're called key TAM relators, private persons in the name of the government. These cases can be brought by them as well. And they don't have to, like I said, they don't have to show specific intent to deceive. It's this mushy standard, so it gives them more wiggle room, more flexibility.
Yeah, so just let's talk about that a little bit, tease that out, as they say. And when you're talking about reckless disregard, we're talking about things if, the government will look at if they're doing an audit or there's been an allegation, they may look at whether somebody even has a compliance system in place.
Sure.
Or can you give us some of the circumstances
where
the government has said, hey, that's reckless.
Where that's reckless disregard. Right. And yes, absolutely. And this gets right into some of the developments in this area in the last year and a half or so. Even when a contractor has a compliance system in place, there's a case from late last year out of the D.C. Circuit where the issue involved was compliance with the organizational conflict of interest requirements. Those requirements relate to, okay, I'm a company, I'm going to be giving an advice to the government. Do I have other business interests out there that might, influence my ability to give unbiased advice to the government? And the government wants to know about those kinds of things up front, and then they want to know about them during performance. And the contractor in this case had a compliance system in place where they would track their business interests. They had keywords that they could run searches to make sure that they were complying with their obligations. The government brought that case anyway. Because and of course, one of the things the contractor said was, "Look, we couldn't have acted with deliberate ignorance or reckless disregard for the truth. Look at this great system we had in place." And the government said, "Hey, your system wasn't good enough," and they brought the case anyway, and that went to a jury, and the jury ended up agreeing with the government. So even when you have a compliance system in place, it's not necessarily a silver bullet. That, of course, is not to say you shouldn't have it.
Right.
You should absolutely have it, because if you don't have it, then you're really potentially up a creek. But you've got to be careful. Even though you have it, it may not get you off the hook.
Okay, and right, we have a hook right now, Jason, because we do have to take a break.
Okay.
But when we return, we'll be talking more with Jason Workmaster, partner, McKenna Long and Aldridge, LLP, and we're doing our fall update. We're talking a little bit right now about the Civil False Claims Act. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Government year-end is fast approaching. Look to GSA Advantage and the Han Company now and anytime you're challenged with a compressed time frame or to do more but spend less. Now more than 400 of Han's newest and top models are available online and at great manufacturer direct prices. You'll find multipurpose chairs, smart desk solutions, durable storage cabinets, contemporary conference tables, and more to fit any office need. All meet or exceed government sustainability requirements, too. To shop Han Direct, go to gsaadvantage.gov and type Han's contract number 27F, like furniture, 0015S, like Sam, in the search bar. That's 27F0015S. When you need office furniture, GSA Advantage is a quick, safe way to buy online, and Han lets you stretch your budget without compromising quality or style. Buy Han Direct. Go to gsaadvantage.gov and search contract 27F0015S today.
The era of big data is here. Agencies must be able to quickly and effectively analyze the entire spectrum of information to make critical decisions in real time. Find out how to exploit big data for mission success on November 16th at the premier government big data event of the year, the MarkLogic Government Summit. Hear about the latest trends, practices, and innovations from industry experts and special guest General Michael Hayden, former director of the NSA and CIA. Register today at MarkLogic.com. That's MarkLogic.com.
The website of the week is the Google Transparency Report. Now, this site includes an interactive map, so you can click on different countries. The Chinese officials consider censorship demands to be state secrets, so we cannot disclose that information at this time. This can show traffic patterns. If a country blocks internet access, you can immediately see this. You can see if any countries are blocking internet traffic. The Google Transparency Report.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
In an era of fiscal constraint marked by shrinking budgets and increasing demands on services, how are local government executives leveraging innovation, common sense, and technology to make a real difference? What is New York City doing to innovatively deliver health and human services? Join host Michael Keegan as he discusses New York City's efforts with Linda Gibbs, Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services of the City of New York. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.
You may not need storage that can withstand the world's harshest conditions, but why risk your mission on anything else? The NetApp FAS 2000 series enables your agency to deploy storage in a smaller, powerful, cost-effective footprint. It's proven in the toughest operating environments on Earth. Delivered by NetApp partners like FCN Technology Solutions, FCN provides IT services and products vital to the operation of your agency. Don't settle. Put your storage solution to the test with a 10-question assessment at netappgov.com.
And now, the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Office of Personnel Management Director John Barry says the federal jobs website, usajobs.gov, is headed in the right direction after a pretty rough debut. OPM has added server capacity and refined features. Director Barry says the agency's response is an example of government working. OPM now faces a congressional hearing and public outrage over that botched rollout. I'm Amy Morris.
Will you be receiving a 25% life insurance premium refund check from your insurance company? Federal employees with WEPA Life Insurance will be receiving over $6 million in premium refunds this fall. Since 1996, WEPA has refunded over $58 million in premiums. In comparison, Fegley has never issued a premium refund. Isn't it time you considered WEPA for your family's life insurance needs? For better insurance, better prices, and better value, visit WAEPA.org. Once again, that's WAEPA.org.
Arming your home security system gives you peace of mind, but are you paying $30, $40, $50 or more in monitoring fees? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems, the metro area's most trusted name in security, and pay just $18.95 a month. That's right, $18.95 a month, and no cost to switch. Don't have a system? Then Ackerman offers the latest technology, including wireless monitoring. Call by Wednesday and get 3 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service with Ackerman. Call 888-999-1070. Ackerman. Security.com.
Join Affirm at their December 8th luncheon for an in-depth discussion of government contracting trends and techniques. Hear highlights on what's hot and what's not in federal acquisition as Tech America unveils usage trends for IDIQs, GWACs, and scheduled contracts. A lively panel moderated by Wyatt Cash of AOL Government will follow with experts from NASA, GSA, NIH, and Navy discussing innovations in government contracting. Lunch and learn with Affirm at the Sofitel Hotel on Thursday, December 8th at noon. Register today at Affirm.org.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jason Workmaster, partner at McKenna, Long & Aldrich. And we're doing our fall sort of legal update, and we've been talking a little bit about this, you know, current, I guess, trends and outlook with regard to the Civil False Claims Act. And when we took our break, Jason, you were talking a little bit about what the government must establish, or what some of the elements or factual things you need to look at, or that with regard to whether it's reckless disregard or with regard to submission of a false claim.
Yeah, and the real action in the last couple of years in the cases has just been when the contractor is submitting an invoice, but at the time it's submitting its invoice, maybe it's not in compliance with some statute or some regulation that's relevant to the contract, or
even some basic contract requirement,
or even just a contract provision. You know, maybe it's not in compliance with that, and so the question that's been coming up in the cases a lot is, okay, is it enough for the to make out a Civil False Claims Act case for the government or a relator to allege, hey, the contractor is not in compliance with this regulation, statute, or contract term, and they're submitting their invoice at the same time, even though of course the invoice itself doesn't say anything like, oh, and by the way, we're in compliance with all the provisions of our contract, or we're in compliance with that particular provision. And that's really been where the action's been, and where the courts have been struggling is that the contractors, and this doesn't only come up for contractors, it also comes up in the context of any submission of a claim to the government. A lot of these cases are in the Medicare and Medicaid space.
Sure, yes. Yeah.
The question that's come up is, the contractor, the folks submitting the claims are saying, well, in order for the government to rely on the Civil False Claims Act here, they've got to show that whatever this provision was that I wasn't in compliance, that I allegedly wasn't in compliance with, they got to show that that was an express condition of payment. So, for example, the statute says, you can't take kickbacks, and if you do, we won't pay you. It's that, and if you do, we won't pay you.
Okay.
That the contractors are saying, you've got to have that kind of language before you can put us on the hook under the FCA. And the direction that most courts, the state of the law, first of all, the state of the law on this area is very confused. It's all kind of, courts are kind of all over the map on it, and it's kind of tough to make broad generalizations about where the courts are. But the trend in this area has seemed to be that the courts that have taken up this issue, old cases from 10 years ago or so would have said, yeah, you've got to have that express language. Courts now seem to be more saying, no, you don't. You don't. And the question is simply, is it when you're looking at, say, a contract provision?
Sure.
Is it a material contract provision? Are you not in compliance with a material contract provision? And then the question, of course, is, okay, what does that mean? And the courts on that have said so far, well, a material provision is a provision that is not minor, or is a provision that is not ancillary to the contract, which, you kind of scratch your head and say, well, how does that help me much with figuring out what is material?
I'm a lawyer. Now I'm confused as to what material or minor is,
right,
or
exactly
ancillary.
Right.
So, so for example, would the Trade Agreements Act be considered ancillary, minor? Is it material? Because ultimately, right, what happened, I mean, the government is getting, in all likelihood, getting a product that works.
Right.
Maybe actually be paying less because of Trade Agreements Act.
Right.
Countries, their, you know, the cost of doing business is probably higher in most cases. So what are the damages there? You know, and
that's
I know,
that's exactly right, and it does lead right into that question of how has the government been harmed, you know, in that kind of area, and it's tough. I mean, there have been a number of cases involving compliance with the Trade Agreements Act brought under the False Claims Act, and for the most part, those have resulted in some kind of settlement. So I don't have a definitive answer from the courts on that one. But certainly, the key TAM relators and the government have not, you know, backed away from those cases on the grounds that, you know, the TAA is a non-material provision of the contract.
Sure. So there's another. It seems to me is really related to this whole area too. When you're talking about contract compliance and whether that rises to the level of a civil false claims act, and that's like is the mandatory disclosure rule.
Absolutely.
Right? Where under this clause, it's in the FAR now. You know, contractors are required to disclose a report to the IG with a CC to the contracting officers. Credible evidence, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. Credible evidence of any violation of the Civil False Claims
Act,
right? Or other government type contract ethics statutes, whether it's bribery statutes, gratuities, that kind of thing. So how does that play together? I mean, and it seems to me what I've heard is I think there's approximately 40. Such disclosures to the GSAIG, and these are approximate numbers, and I know it's been, and what is it? DOD has the most, right?
Right.
And we're talking a couple hundred or 300, something like that. Somewhere in that range. I mean, I don't know the numbers, but it's, you know, and so how does, if I'm a contractor and I'm looking at that obligation under the contract, and the civil, how do I handle, I mean, it almost to a certain sense, Does it, I guess I'll ask you this question this way, does it lead to a situation where contractors and even the government are looking at what used to be routine contract administration issues that could be corrected with the CO in a whole different lens? Like now they have to go through a calculation. Wow. Does that rise to the level of something I need to report? And just have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the mandatory... It does add a level of complexity to the analysis because, of course, you know, responsible government contractors want to be in compliance with the terms of their contracts, and if one of those terms is a mandatory disclosure rule, they want to abide by it. The tough part is, of course, determining when you have credible evidence of a Civil False Claims Act violation, because to have a Civil False Claims Act violation, one of the elements of such a violation is that the contractor must have acted with reckless disregard or deliberate ignorance. Well, how do you know if you have credible evidence of reckless disregard? You know, you have two very mushy concepts then coming together.
Right.
You know, first you got the reckless disregard, which is mushy in and of itself, and then you have to make the determination, okay, well, now do I have credible evidence, which is also mushy, of reckless disregard. So it's that's very tricky. And I think that, you know, practically speaking, you know, it's tough to say that, you know, if you truly do have a Civil False Claims Act problem and you fail to disclose in accordance with the mandatory disclosure rule, you're simply adding to your existing problems. You know, you already have a big problem, which is the Civil False Claims Act problem, and that you're just really what you're doing is giving the suspension and debarring official a potential another hook to suspend or debar you for the failure to report the Civil False Claims Act violation. But if you really do have a Civil False Claims Act violation, you're probably going to get debarred or suspended anyway. So, you know, it's kind of a belt and suspenders. In my opinion, the mandatory disclosure rule is really a belt and suspenders for the government. Because, again, the Civil False Claims Act already provides them a lot of protection.
Yeah. Well, and it's, I mean, I don't know if you knew this, but one thing we learned at the conference is that those, you know, those disclosures, those mandatory disclosures, I think the IGs, as I understood it, they do, send them over to the Department of Justice when they get them. So they are doing that too. So that's kind of interesting as well, it seems to me. That doesn't mean that they're acting on each and every one from a civil law claim act perspective, but they are, making folks aware of internally what's going on.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I guess one thing that maybe I should have pointed out at the beginning, why does this matter so much? Why does the government want the protections of the False Claims Act? Why is it taking, the government and the key TAM relators, why are they taking these aggressive positions and not just treating, what's the incentive for the government here as opposed to treating these issues as pure matters of contract administration? Well, the incentive is that it's, the False Claims Act provides for treble damages. So, you calculate, your TAA example, Roger, it's unclear exactly how you calculate damages there. Because again, if the allegation is, you contractor sold the government a computer from the People's Republic of China, the government still has the computer, right? And so they got the thing that they were buying. It might not have been from the country they wanted it to be from.
And it presumably works.
Works. And none of these cases that have raised allegations of the TAA have asserted otherwise. None of them have said, and the government got shoddy stuff.
Right.
The theory in those cases has been, the government has taken a policy position that it doesn't want stuff from certain places, and so we're going to calculate the damages as the value of what was sold. And if you're already in that rubric, if that were to stand up to judicial scrutiny, if we ever get there and get a decision on this, you take that number and then you multiply it by three. That's what the contractor owes. So that's why the stakes are so high in the Civil False Claims Act.
Yeah, and I have a number now too, and it's time for a break. I'm on my number.
All right.
So when we come back, we'll be talking more with Jason Workmaster, partner McKenna Long and Aldridge. We've been doing a little compliance legal update, and we're in fall season. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Government year-end is fast approaching. Look to GSA Advantage and the Han Company now and anytime you're challenged with a compressed time frame or to do more but spend less. Now more than 400 of Han's newest and top models are available online and at great manufacturer direct prices. You'll find multi-purpose chairs, smart desk solutions, durable storage cabinets, contemporary conference tables, and more to fit any office need. All meet or exceed government sustainability requirements, too. To shop Han Direct, go to gsaadvantage.gov and type Han's contract number 27F, like furniture, 0015S, like Sam, in the search bar. That's 27F0015S. When you need office furniture, GSA Advantage is a quick, safe way to buy online, and Han lets you stretch your budget without compromising quality or style. Buy Han Direct. Go to gsaadvantage.gov and search contract 27F0015S today.
To win and deliver government contracts successfully, you need to align with the right teaming partners. Meet Tech Systems. While often behind the scenes, Tech Systems has worked with government agencies and systems integrators for over 25 years. In fact, every year, they deploy over 70,000 IT professionals at over 5,500 client sites nationwide, including more than 65 government agencies. Tech Systems is active across a broad spectrum of government programs and has developed deep relationships to understand what works well and who does it best. Thinking about cybersecurity? Working on a cloud computing initiative? Tech Systems addresses critical program gaps related to people, projects, and work functions. Their delivery models scale from staff augmentation to IT project and outsourcing services to support transition, ramp-up, surge, and ongoing program support needs. Learn more at TechSystems.com. TEKSystems.com.
Now there's a simpler way to pay for the goods and services your agency needs. Using GSA Smart Pay 2, cardholders can buy large ticket items, make recurring payments, and conduct micro purchases without delays. You can even use GSA Smart Pay 2 to make payments for contracts, grants, utility bills, and much more. Accepted around the world, GSA Smart Pay 2 works just like the charge cards you already know, while offering a broad range of benefits. With GSA Smart Pay 2, you gain access to powerful financial tools to provide you with insight and control over your agency's expenses. Best of all, GSA SmartPay 2 is a proven and effective way to save the government millions of dollars. To find out more about GSA SmartPay 2, visit smartpay.gsa.gov. That's smartpay.gsa.gov. GSA SmartPay 2, a simpler, unified way to pay.
Where did you leave it? Where could it have possibly gone? It's frustrating because you used to have your motivation with you all the time, and now, ugh. That's okay. We'll help you find it. First, let's find your reason. You know, your reason. What's that thing that makes you want to live to an age where you can say whatever you want to whomever you want and somehow it becomes charming? Next, find your thing. What is that healthy thing you actually love doing? There's got to be one, right? Finally, go find your partner. Who's the ping to your pong? The downward to your dog? Who'll keep your butt moving and vice versa? Find all of those things, we're pretty sure your motivation will magically appear. But if you're still having trouble finding it, try looking really, really hard in the mirror. We're Kaiser Permanente, and we're here to help you find your motivation to thrive. Visit kp.org/thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Have you been in government contracting, procurement, or acquisition for 30 years? NCMA has. Join the National Contract Management Association for the 30th Annual Government Contract Management Conference, November 14th and 15th in Bethesda, Maryland. The conference draws more than 1,000 government contract management professionals. Hear from respected speakers such as Scott Gould, Deputy Secretary, Department of Veterans Affairs, Martha Johnson, Administrator, GSA, and Shay Assad, Director, Defense Pricing, DOD. Learn more at ncmahq.org today.
Your clothing could one day communicate much more than your fashion sense. Because if John Valakis, director of Ohio State University's Electro Science Laboratory, has his way, your shirt will be part antenna.
The actual fabric is going to look the same. You won't know the difference, but it will be conductive.
So it can send and receive signals like a smartphone, only better, because Valakis says a lot of antenna can be woven into your clothes.
If there's a signal there, and the signal is very low, you now have a much stronger antenna on your body that will overcome the low signal from the tower.
And if the signal's good, Valakis says sending even high-resolution video would be seamless. Benefits could include home monitoring of patients, but the technology is still in early stages of development and testing. To find out more about this and other engineering innovation stories, please go to www.nae.edu/radio. That's nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jason Workmaster. Jason is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, focusing on government contracts and Civil False Claims Act. And actually, that's what we've been talking about, the Civil False Claims Act and, you know, current events, recent trends, that sort of thing. And, you know, Jason, I understand there are a number of statutory slash regulatory developments regarding, you know, fraud in this area in the small business program context.
Yes.
Can you tell us about those?
Yes, and this has gotten a lot of attention over the last couple of years, both from Congress and at the regulatory level. And, you know, last year, 2010, Congress passed and the president signed the Small Business Jobs Act of 2010. And then just recently, here in the last few weeks, there have been some proposed rules promulgated, put out for comment to implement the Small Business Jobs Act of 2010.
They were put out by the SBA.
Put out by the SBA, yeah. And the you know, the probably the headline, both of the act and of these proposed regs, is that in the small business context, a contractor that willfully misrepresents its small business status is going to be there will be an irrefutable, which can't contest it, presumption. You love how lawyers talk.
Some of us do.
Yeah.
Some of us not so much.
But an irrefutable presumption that the government, the damage the government has sustained is the full value of the contract that was awarded to the small business that was found to have willfully misrepresented its size status. And again, how does that relate to the False Claims Act? Again, we're right back to what we were talking about before. That number will be taken, that damages number, and then it will be multiplied by three. So if you are a small business, if you are a business that misrepresents, is found to have misrepresented your small business status and gotten a contract because of it, you'll be on the hook for three times what you made on the contract. And, you know, that's the first time. This is the first time we're now seeing that, you know, a non-compliance in a specific area, you know, this small business area, is by regulation going to result in what we call whole contract value type damages. There was a case from a few years back down in Texas. Went up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals that had said in the SBIR context, Small Business Independent Research context, where the government's just giving money to small businesses to do independent research, right, and the government's not actually getting anything back. There was a case in that context that said, when the government's not getting anything, of course, then the measure of damages is the full value that the contractor was given. You know, but this rule is saying, even now, where the small business has delivered value, you know, has delivered the desktop computers or the services or whatever is whatever the contract was for, even when that has happened, and there's no allegation that there was anything wrong with what was delivered, the contractor's still going to have to pay back every dollar.
So I'm just curious, and I haven't looked at that part of it. Is that actually in the act, or is it the way the SBA implemented?
It's in the act.
Oh, okay.
And in the proposed rule.
Wow.
So the proposed rule is just piggybacking on the act.
Okay. Well, the implications of this, it seems to me, you know, it's setting a precedent here that, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, these things develop legs.
They do.
They do.
And what we've seen also in the last few years, you know, this issue we were discussing earlier about how broad, excuse me, how broad is the scope of False Claims Act liability? You know, what contract noncompliances can it reach? You know, does it have to be this express condition of payment or whatever? You know, that issue is perhaps making its way up to the Supreme Court here. That issue is the subject of a case that there's a pending petition for the court to hear the case. The court hasn't decided that yet. But what we've seen in the past is that when the Supreme Court has taken these False Claims Act cases and then done something with them that Congress doesn't like, Congress comes along right behind,
right,
and reverses what it was the Supreme Court just did. So, you know, if, you know, in this, you know, just to see this happening with the small business arena, you know, my guess would be is if the Supreme Court were to say, no, we're going to limit False Claims Act liability, you know, that might get the attention of people in Congress, and they'll just amend the statute.
Yeah, and I guess from your perspective, what sort of drove? I mean, this is it's a pretty significant change in the way you formulate this thing. What drove this? Is it just the concern that there are too many companies out there who say they're small and really aren't, or what is it?
I think that's exactly it. There's been a lot of press over the last year and a half or so, involving Alaska Native corporations. That's, I think, gotten some attention up on the Hill. There was a large company that was recently suspended not too long ago for allegedly using, you know, small businesses basically as fronts. You know, that made a lot of press, and I do think when stuff hits the press, that's when, you know, it starts getting the political folks interested.
Right, and then there's, you know, rules made based on, anecdotal situations,
exactly,
or,
right,
you know, a perception of a situation, yeah, that, you know, is outside the norm, as,
right,
opposed to the way the system works each,
right,
and every day.
Exactly. And politically speaking, who is going to stand up and say they're against cracking down on fraud? You know, I mean, that's a politically tough one.
Right now, we do have to take a break. When we return, we'll be for our final segment, we'll be talking more with Jason Workmaster, partner McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, and we're just going to talk maybe a little bit protest action. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
The Cloud Conundrum, Public, Private, or Both? A panel discussion with experts from government and industry, sponsored by Brocade. Panelist Anthony Robbins, Vice President of Federal Sales, Brocade.
The world today is going to spend about $40 billion on information technology capabilities to enable the cloud. By the year 2020, the world is going to spend in excess of $244 billion on information technology to enable the cloud. And so I can assure you what the commercial IT companies like Brocade are going to do is they're going to begin all of their development efforts and all their R&D alignment to enable the cloud capabilities.
Cloud innovations are here. Is your network optimized? Accelerate to the cloud with Brocade's new technology and business models. Brocade's cloud-optimized solutions provide a foundation to help organizations migrate to private clouds. What does this mean to your agency? Increased utilization, simplified management, and an agile organization. That's why Brocade solutions are used in over 90% of global 1,000 data centers. Learn how Brocade will transition your organization to a virtualized world. Go to federalnewsradio.com. Search cloud.
Here's Jeremy Grant, Senior Executive Advisor, Identity Management, NIST, on the Federal Executive Forum on Trusted Identities and Identity Management, sponsored by Deloitte.
What we're really trying to create through NSTIC is what's dubbed an identity ecosystem, which is an environment where individuals and organizations can choose from a variety of different technologies to more easily authenticate online in a way that will enhance privacy, enhance choice, and enhance security. And the way that you can choose from a variety of different technologies is by adherence to common set of standards and policies.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Looking for tips to re-energize your agency's IT approach? Deloitte's top 10 technology trends share lessons from the front line, from real analytics to capability clouds to cybersecurity. Challenge conventional thinking and discover new pathways to efficiency, performance, and innovation. To download the report, visit Deloitte.com/federal. That's Deloitte.com/federal. Deloitte, helping government help America.
Previously on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, there was a special panel conversation about the F-35 program. Discussing the fundamental principles of the program is Tom Burbidge, Executive VP and GM of F-35 Program Integration.
The fundamental principles of the program, there's four of them. The first one is that the system needs to be lethal. If you do call on, you know, our successors, our children, our grandchildren, to actually have to go employ this in combat, you want it to be lethal and get the job done. The second one is you want it to be survivable. You want it to come home at the end of the fight. And probably from the military technology side, those are the two areas that are most advanced with this technology that we're talking about. The third thing is you want it to be supportable over the life cycle of the program to drive down that cost of ownership we're talking about. And the fourth one they label as affordability. I want to attack all the things that drive the cost of maintaining a military air power capability, whether it's single service, joint service, or coalition.
To listen to the whole program, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword F-35.
Hey, Caps fans, here's your chance to be a VIP. On February 10th, join legends Crazy 8 Ovechkin, Deuces Wild Knuble, and King of Hearts Like at the third annual Caps Care Casino Night and Auction, and go all in for a great cause. Tickets include food, drinks, and games with Capitals players and coaches, with all proceeds benefiting Washington Capitals charities. For more information, log on to WashingtonCaps.com.
What Facebook has done, they're transforming advertising. With Google click-through, you don't really know who's clicking through. But with Facebook, you can so specify who's looking at your ads that it's extremely targeted. That's why Google is so worried, because Facebook has created this closed ecosystem. They don't allow Google search into their little private kingdom. And Google is afraid that the Facebook community will become larger than Google's.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
As an increased number of government agencies transform to a cloud infrastructure, IT is being viewed less as a product buy and more as a service. From acquisition and procurement to the SLAs that map them, the transition to storage, email, and infrastructure as a service stands to rewrite the basic processes of federal IT. Join AFSEA Bethesda and Dave McClure, the associate administrator at GSA, on November 16th at the Bethesda North Marriott to discuss how agencies are managing this transition. Register today at afseabethesda.org/NOVbreakfast.
This is Mark Amtower. I've been advising contractors for almost 30 years, and when they need agency contacts, I always recommend Carroll's GovSearch. With over 350,000 contact listings and over 1,000 government organization charts, they help you find the people you need to reach in all levels of government. Give them a try. Get a free organization chart and a sample listing from their database. Contact Gordon Peel at 703-757-8228. Carroll Publishing, bringing government to you like no other.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jason Workmaster. Jason is a partner at McKenna, Long & Aldridge, focusing on government contracts, compliance issues, and bid protests. And this segment, we're going to talk a little bit protests and whatever else we think of in the legal area that's going on these days. But, Jason, what are you seeing in regard to bid protests in terms of the issues that are coming up?
The big issue, of course, is just lots of volume. I haven't seen the most recent statistics from GAO, but just from what we're witnessing at McKenna, just the volume is through the roof in terms of folks being willing to pursue protests. And again, hearkening back to what you were saying about the economic climate, the state of the budget, taking those givens, I think that's a lot of the reason we're seeing the uptick in protest activity. There's a sense that the pie is shrinking, that there's a smaller pot of contracts to be chasing. And in that type of climate, people are more willing to pull the trigger on chasing a protest, whereas in the past they weren't.
So let me get this right. I was going to say, part of it you think is, with all the uncertainty on budgets and continuing resolutions, yep, and whether this program's going to be funded or future elements of it, that folks are seeing, there's a contract today, but we don't know if there's going to be one tomorrow.
That's right.
And you think that's leading folks to
I think it is. I think it is. And again, that's putting aside the question of whether the protests are
meritorious
meritorious or not. I think in the past, when the times were better, a good number of meritorious protests probably weren't pursued, just because we don't want to go and sue our customer. Whereas now, if you think you have a meritorious protest, you're more likely to bring it and run the risk of potentially alienating a customer.
Yeah. Well, you talked about suing the customer, which I know folks are everybody's sort of reluctant to do. If you're selling to them, obviously,
yes.
But
yes.
State the obvious, Raj. But the other, I guess, could you just? I think it might be interesting to sort of walk through the sort of decision making process,
yeah,
people go through when they're working with their attorneys.
Yep.
And deciding whether to file a bid protest, because that is one thing, from my experience in private practice, that folks do think about, like, oh, okay, and people who are going to late, they still think long and hard about,
yes,
suing their customer.
Yes.
Can you talk about the factors and things?
Sure. And it helps probably just to talk through it in terms of kind of a timeline.
Absolutely.
And where this always starts is that you've put in your proposal and the letter comes in the mail one day, or you get the email that says you lost. And then what typically would happen, at least in a FAR Part 15 procurement competitive negotiation, oftentimes even in ones that aren't, you'll get some kind of a debriefing as to telling you here's areas of your proposal you could have improved, so you could have had a better chance of getting an award, so that if you come back and compete in the future, here's the things that maybe will help you. That's the purpose. That's the purpose of a debriefing. The purpose from the government's perspective of a debriefing isn't to give people grounds to go and protest over, but that is where we look. And of course, what you would then look for is, all right, well, if this was a procurement where there were discussions held, and the government is saying you lost because of you had this significant weakness here, well, if there were multiple rounds of discussions and your proposal in that area was always exactly the same, you would say, well, you should have told me about that.
Right.
Back when we were doing discussions, you should have told me about that so I could have had a chance to fix it. So that's, of course, continues to be a robust area for protests.
And that's an easy one for GAO to say,
yep.
They can live clear. I mean, I saw it when I was in private practices. That's one where they can clearly say, there's some prejudice there because we don't know what the outcome would have been.
Probably the clearest path to a sustained protest is those facts, is a lack of meaningful discussions. Because as you were saying, Roger, GAO is close to presuming that there was some kind of prejudice to the protester. You know, outside of that, you know, we're seeing, I think we're seeing a lot of protests involving allegations where the government failed to conduct the proper realism analysis. You know, so you've got the meaningful discussions issues. You've got issues regarding the evaluation of price or the evaluation of proposed cost. You know, that the agency somehow tripped up there. I think what we're seeing a lot of there is allegations that the government, you know, because again, the pressure is on to go low price. So
yes,
when the government is awarding to higher priced offerors right now, you see plenty of people coming in and saying, you know, you didn't take this into account, you didn't take that into account. How can you do this? You know, look at this budget. You know, you got to take this into account. At the same time, when the government is awarding to the low price, because, you know, again, they're under pressure to do so right now, they're going low price, you're seeing a lot of protests where the allegation is that guy just lowballed it, he doesn't know what he's doing, you missed it, agency, there's no way a guy could, you know, there's no way anybody could do it for that price, and you screwed up your price realism analysis. So we're seeing a lot of protests like that. And then just your standard old, you know, hey, you evaluated my proposal wrong. You know, the technical evaluation was unreasonable. That's not what I proposed. You're all wet. But like you said, probably the continuing to be the clearest path to a sustain is the discussions issue.
So let me ask you a couple questions along the lines of MythBusters. And, you know, number one, you know, Dan Gordon, the administrator for federal procurement policy, spoke at the coalition's fall conference last week. And he said an interesting thing, and I've seen it done. He said, hey, you know, why not give... there was a discussion about debriefings. Why not give, a losing offeror, you know, redacted as appropriate, right? But a copy of the evaluation documents, or at least a summary of why that sort of explains how they got the ratings they got. What do you think of that?
Yeah, and some agencies are doing that on their own anyway. It kind of depends from what perspective you're looking at that question. It really does. If the interest is in resolving the procurement, getting to the end as fast as possible, I think that makes a lot of sense, because one of two things are going to happen if that is done, in my opinion. Either it is going to reveal that the agency made a big mistake.
Right.
It usually takes
a big mistake in an evaluation.
It usually takes a big mistake. But if you release that kind of document appropriately redacted to the offeror, it's either going to early on float a big mistake, which will prompt a protest, which, you know, hopefully if it's a clear error, the agency will take corrective action and, you know, we'll be off to the races again. Or, you know, a lot of times, at least in my experience with folks losing offerors, they want to know why. And so, you know, and if when they get, when all they get is a couple sentences saying, well, we like the other guy better and he was cheaper, it just doesn't satisfy the need that a lot of folks feel that, like, I just want an explanation. I don't mind having lost, but I want an explanation for why.
But it's also part of their business, right? I mean, because they've spent bid and proposal costs to compete for something, so they've made an investment, and they actually do, you know, from the government perspective too, those folks who are on the losing team or whoever is a manager, proposal manager, they've got to go back and explain to their management why this happened.
Yes, absolutely, and really to go back to that fundamental point of the debriefing in the first place, it really is true to take that information and do better in the future. I mean, that's the point. Right. So I'm in favor of it. I think it's better for the process to do that. And I understand why agencies may be reluctant to do so, because they're worried about just, you know, giving fodder to protest lawyers. I can understand that. I guess the only thing I can say in response to that is I have yet to have a client ever tell me, you know, go file a frivolous protest for me.
Right.
People don't do that. Yeah. They don't want to waste their
money. Because
they cost
money, too.
It costs money.
Yeah. Well, Jason, I want to thank you for joining me today. I'm Roger Waldron, and this is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition of Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.